Giant's Voice.
The official podcast of the U.S. Navy's largest overseas installation, Commander Fleet Activities Yokosuka. This is the Giant Voice Podcast.
A quick warning before we start. This episode includes conversation about suicide and mental health. Listener's discretion is advised. Hey everyone, welcome back to the Giant Voice Podcast. It's been a minute since our last episode, but I'm glad we're back. And today we're diving into a topic that really matters. It's suicide prevention and resiliency in our military community. We're going to talk about what to look out for, the resources that are there, and the ways we can build each other up so nobody feels like they're carrying that weight alone. I would like to introduce Lieutenant Commander Joanne Vedva, a licensed clinical social worker who's led resiliency and mental health programs all over the fleet. Is that correct?
That's correct.
We also got HM2 Victor Finch, a behavioral health tech here at Yokosuka, who's been on the line with Marines and sailors across the Indo-PACOM.
That is true.
All right. And then we also have Ms. Laura Philpott, a licensed mental health counselor who's now leading the substance abuse rehabilitation program at U.S. Naval Hospital Yokosuka. And they're here to share their perspective and experience on how we can all recognize the signs, build stronger support systems, and be there for each other. So let's get into it. I guess we can kick it off about risk factors and warning signs, things for people to look for when encountering someone who's potentially suicidal. One of the questions I have are, what are suicide risk factors or warning signs that everyone should understand?
So I'd like to talk about that. We've been trained on how to recognize risk factors, and they range. They could be a fall from grace. They could be increased use of alcohol, poor performance, things like that. I would like to talk more about a theory of interpersonal suicide or interpersonal theory of suicide by Thomas Joyner, though. And the reason why I want to talk about that is because it leads to safety plans.
Okay.
And, you know, safety plans is what keeps people alive. So let's just talk about those risk factors first. So Thomas Joyner did some studies and found three common things. One of them is a thwarted sense of belonging, like not feeling connected, feeling like an outcast. Another one is feeling a sense of burdensomeness. So if you look at those two risk factors, those are very interpersonal type. And then the third one is access to lethal means. So if we have access to firearms or medications we can overdose on, another serious risk factor. So if you look at those three and you look at, you recognize those as risk factors and how to like protect against those risk factors, what kind of things come to mind?
I mean, a lot of what we do in our line of work, if you're not feeling part of the group or if you're not feeling a part of the team, really. A lot of people who kind of are by themselves, they don't go with the group when they're invited to events. And especially those that have an intrigue and maybe weapons, such as maybe blades. Maybe they like blade collections or they're a gun collector. But they're also very antisocial. Those could be some things to look out for.
Some things if you see a change, like if there's all of a sudden more like that. But things to think about, too, is if we as people are offering connection and having a sense of community and belonging, we're extending that to our fellow community member. That's what we do to protect our community. And if somebody is suffering from something like that, they're not always going to want to come out and say it because they're already feeling so burdensome. So those are some really good risk factors to think about. And why I bring those up is because then comes a safety plan. And I don't know if anybody's ever heard of a safety plan ever. Does that sound like, is that something familiar to anyone here, safety plans?
I do them often, so yes.
I do them every day.
So like for those of us who work in mental health, we are very familiar with safety plans. We do those, perform those with our patients who come in to keep them safe. The safety plan involves people on the outside. So if we're talking about that social connectedness, in the safety plan, it lists, like maybe on in the middle of it, who can I reach out to if I'm having trouble managing my warning signs? And so we can have a part to play in that safety plan. Somebody can ask us one day, can I list you as that social person contact to be on my safety plan? So if somebody ever asks you to, that's a, you know, something to consider as a responsibility and a commitment to keeping somebody safe, keeping somebody alive. So going on to the safety plan and why I talked about Thomas Joyner is because it's meant to help people independently cope and develop their own strategies to work through their warning signs. The first part of a VA safety plan is how do you recognize the warning signs? And then what can you do internally to cope? Let's talk about the strategies that we can work with you on. So like HM2's Finch does them every day. That's what he covers when he's meeting people in mental health. Do you want to elaborate more on some of those other points in the safety plan?
So when you're dealing with a safety plan, you want to put up stuff that could be a block to you doing the unthinkable. You know, like listening to music, playing video games, anything that de-stresses you. And as you're listing points of contact, I always tell our clients that it doesn't need to be somebody you like. It just needs to be somebody that you can 100% count on. So even if you haven't talked to them in a while, if you can pick up a phone, call them, and they answer and they will come to you, list them 100%. Then from there, we go through the resources of what's available on the base and then finish it off with why. Give us the one best reason that you have for being here, for staying in this life. What is keeping you here? And that, as soon as you answer that, a lot of times that's like a turning point for people. It's like, I need to be here for either my family, my friends, pets, anything.
Great point. HM2 Finch is talking about protective factors. Anytime we're talking about protection against suicide, we want to bolster all of that protection. And the more you do that, the more the suicide ideation resolves, or the more that warning, that crisis mode resolves. So additionally, with safety planning comes a very important responsibility, which is means restriction. So when it comes to suicide, and if someone makes a decision to follow through with committing suicide, it can be made within an hour or less. So if you commit someone to remove any lethal means, that keeps them alive like three times as much or like even more. So confiscating firearms just temporarily, just until they're out of crisis, or removing any kind of medications or anything that could be ropes or things like that, that is another part of the safety plan, as mentioned in that theory of interpersonal suicide by Thomas Joyner, is access to lethal means. So if you look at those risk factors and you do everything you can to minimize them, we can, you know, keep people alive. And then bolstering that protection, what is my reason for living? What is who relies on me? If you focus the conversation more on that, that becomes that beautiful protection. Ms. Philpott, is there anything you want to add to the safety plans when you do them?
Yeah, absolutely. I really like to try and encourage any patient to see the safety plan as a form of empowerment versus it taking away their power. So when we look at means restriction, it's also them having to actively engage in making those decisions. Who do I want to have my medications or have my weapons? And helping them kind of decide, like, who do I trust to share this information with? Safety plans should be kind of an active form. It should be something that we're able to say, I don't have to be suicidal to engage in the information and strategies. I just have to recognize I'm struggling and to remind myself, like, hey, I have something that kind of can help give me some focus, that can empower me and remind me what kind of activities are meaningful to me? What are the people that are meaningful and safe for me? And so safety plans aren't a form of I've failed and I have to turn to this, but a form of empowerment to help generate that safety and hopefully connection as well.
And I do think that that all those points make sense. It's more of not feeling like a failure whenever everybody reaches a low point, right? Like nobody's impervious to depression or sadness or anxiety. Just because you haven't been diagnosed, that doesn't mean that you haven't experienced that at some point in life, and that it's more powerful to reach out for help than it is to just think you have it on your own. I would rather someone feel like a burden and ask me for help rather than them feeling like they have to fight alone, because they don't. Nobody has to.
I think that's one of those things too, is language is so powerful when we're talking about anything we're struggling with, you know, and I always turn to the word connection, because the, you know, one of those risk factors is that disconnection. When we don't feel we belong, we don't feel like we have connection with others or that meaning. And so asking for help, it's maybe you don't like that word. Some people get really sensitive about, I don't want to ask for help. Well, can you ask for connection? You know, is there a place or is there a person that you can actually ask, hey, I need to connect. That's what I need. And even if it's something you don't want to verbalize, setting that intention internally is like, I'm going to reach out to this person because I need connection right now. That can be really powerful way to switch some of that thinking around too.
People may not really know or understand or take the time to determine what they're feeling. But then it happens so quickly. People are so individual and individualized in how they respond to stress. They can respond very severely, very quickly, and then it just comes before them before they know it. And so reaching out in a decision to do that with somebody they trust, because your LPO laid that for you, your LPO made himself available, made himself approachable, and that's what we need to do as a community, is make it okay to come and talk to us. And, you know, there's no judgment here. We're just so concerned about you. And so when we enact that as a community, then more people will come out and express what they're struggling with. And, you know, suicide prevention or suicide risk and mental health, those can be totally separate things. You don't always, you know, directly correlate the two. There can be people who have taken their lives and we've never seen them in mental health. So so if we have this climate of connection, we inculcate a culture of that, that's how we protect ourselves against those kinds of risks.
And to add on to that, you know, opening up the conversations are outside of crisis, you know, outside of even Suicide Awareness Month, and normalizing that it is okay for us to talk about those feelings. And one of the things that I see happen a lot with family, friends, loved ones, coworkers, of people who are struggling with those thoughts, is this really deep fear and anxiety of those who love someone struggling, of I don't know what to say and I don't know what to do. And so the more we as communities are able to talk about these conversations and normalize, like, hey, anyone can have these feelings, have these experiences, and let's talk about that. Those are all things that are going to reduce risk, help people feel more confident and more connected. Because there's nothing worse than when someone comes to someone they care about and they try and be vulnerable and share, and the other person locks up and freezes because they're so worried they're going to say the wrong thing, then disconnection has happened. And so, you know, having these podcasts, having these conversations, regardless of what time of the year it is or, you know, what's happening in our lives, it's powerful.
We would want to do a podcast like this because we would want people to come forward, come and seek services, see an uptick in referring themselves to our resources here on base, whether it be mental health or Fleet and Family or additional resources like seeing a chaplain. We would love for there to be people listening right now and determining, hey, you know, I really have been wanting to talk to somebody for a while. So that's why we do these things.
I just want to jump in on what Ma'am said. So mental health and suicide awareness don't always go hand in hand, because it can happen at any time. It'd be a loss of a family member, a friend. It could just be a bad day at work. So you can always come to either your mental health staff, reach out to a friend, or whoever you feel comfortable with, RPs, CHAPS, anyone's there to help you. Mental health is not like it was 3 to 5 years ago. There's no longer that giant stigma behind it. So we're trying to get forward in front of everything now, because we've seen the results of not doing it in the past.
HM2 Finch makes me think of something cool. It's called the Brandon Act. Does anybody want to mention what they know about the Brandon Act?
It's all yours.
Go ahead, ma'am.
Sure. Well, that's now a law that anyone can come to receive mental health and be provided access to mental health. And their leadership is responsible for ensuring that access because of that law.
Wasn't that due to the service member that did end up committing suicide with the lack of support from his chain of command?
Yes. So like HM2 Finch is saying, things are changing. The stigma is going away. People want to come forward. We have the access to see them, and we strongly encourage it. Think about things like a toothache or something. You don't want to let it get all abscessy and gross. You want to take care of it early. So if you are not having any kind of suicidal thinking, you can use other resources on base for sure. And if you are, then come to mental health.
I like that. I like it's the importance to normalize suicide, because there's always that stigma just saying the word suicide. I've actually taken a couple courses. I've taken Safe Talk and what is the other one? Assist.
Yes.
And looking at the Diamond Method, which I vaguely remember, but learning like tools of like how to get somebody to, for a split second, decide not to take the actions to take their life.
Mm-hmm.
Just that pause is enough to be able to break that and to be able to save that life. Just asking them questions and then getting them into a safe environment.
Yes.
Could make a huge impact.
Yeah, you make it okay to talk about suicide, sure. And patients feel so relieved because they could be themselves. They could just say what they feel. Additionally, like just to kind of cover more on risk factors, you don't want to make things worse by introducing alcohol. That just adds just this liquid fire to it. So really, really, when people are really down or not themselves or off their usual, adding alcohol to it is the counterintuitive thing to do. And one last thing, there's so many factors and things to consider, but one of the biggest ones is sleep.
Mm-hmm.
If you're not getting enough sleep, you're already setting yourself up for like some wired and tired, some increased agitation. So if you safeguard your sleep and you have healthy habits and you're connecting with people, you're protecting yourself.
And, you know, just connecting back with that substance use, it doesn't have to be just alcohol. You know, from a mental health perspective, especially coming from a trauma-focused and addiction-focused professional experience, substance abuse is usually, or substance use, is really about escaping, right? I'm escaping my hard day at work. And, you know, in the military, it is really common to get together and socialize with, you know, a drink. And so it can be confusing for people to understand how it's wrong or how it's not helpful. I socialize better. I'm a fun person when I do this. You know, I can't talk to people if I haven't had, you know, a glass. And understanding that is still escaping. I am trying to escape who I think of myself. I am trying to escape whatever stressors are at work. And when we get too focused on escaping things, sometimes that impulsivity that accompanies substance use or abuse unfortunately takes people to that place of where they act. And that's why having self-awareness, if possible, being able to talk about things and just being aware of, am I doing this because I genuinely just can handle one glass, or am I trying to escape something? And how impulsive do I behave when I am in that environment or under the influence? Because unfortunately, impulsivity is a huge factor in suicides being attempted and completed. And there's no turning back a lot of the times. And we don't want that happening.
As you were saying, with substance abuse and or alcoholism, there's a higher susceptibility to suicidality due to the lack of inhibitions. Mm-hmm. Things you might not have wanted to do when you're sober come out a lot when you're not.
Yes.
Oh, absolutely, because as soon as you start drinking, that inhibitor in the back of your head that helps you make proper decisions, it's all fogged up.
Yes.
And so you think it's liquid courage. It's really just running away from the responsibility of decision making, in my words, because I also noticed when I was feeling down, I even told my LPL, like, hey, there's been an uptick of me drinking, and I'm not even an alcoholic. Like, I don't, and by that I mean I don't go to social settings to drink, but I noticed when I'm just randomly taking shots because I want to be drunk, I was like, ooh, that's not good. Not just for mental health, also for the body itself, because you're just poisoning it. I really hope that we do another one of these around winter time, because that is definitely a time for being more aware.
Yes, the holiday season does give an uptick to depression, being out here 1,000 miles away from family.
And then changing weather.
The hardest time of the year.
Mm-hmm.
Absolutely. The winter time is a real struggle. Like you said, that kind of a seasonal affect, the being away from family members, or just being around family members. You go home for some R&R and you're around family, and, oh, I forgot how toxic my family is.
Mm-hmm.
Or, unfortunately, if it just lines up that there's some type of family crisis that time of the year, it just piles on. Financial stressors that time of the year. Those are all things that can catch people by surprise.
If I may, I would like to go into the topic of resiliency and some protective factors. We've already covered some of them. Some of those are about the safety plan, where it's, hey, how about we hold off on these weapons or these drugs or maybe even alcohol? Like, hey, I'll hold on to your alcohol for you as part of a safety plan. But how can a part of resiliency and protective factors, how can service members build resiliency?
I'm going to throw out maybe something not always said. Resiliency is becoming more and more of a used word, especially in the military. But what I'm seeing with patients is that it's kind of sometimes counter-effective. Because the thing is, you guys are having to be resilient every day.
Yeah.
And so being told that you need to be more resilient, that can be defeating and exhausting. And so we really need to pay attention to our usage of that word and what it means. And sometimes have to be flexible that maybe the person right now that's struggling doesn't need to hear about how to be more resilient. But some people might. And so I think understanding there are some nuances with this, and that telling people to be more resilient can actually cause damage.
Mm-hmm.
I'm seeing a trend in people that I service who really struggle and feel a lot of negativity just with that word, resiliency. So kind of what I'm trying to be self-aware of and bring into that is to be able to help them connect with how they've already been resilient, so that they know it's not something they need to learn. It's not something that they have to do harder. But to say, look, you are already successful at this. These are the ways you are resilient.
Mm-hmm.
So what else do we need to support you right now? Because maybe sometimes it's like, I need a time out. Right? I need a time out from being resilient. I need to be vulnerable. I need a safe place to cry or scream.
Yeah.
right? And that really is also a part of supporting your resiliency, is sometimes just finding that safe space to take a break from it. That made sense.
Yeah, it makes perfect sense. And so when you asked me if I had, with my experience across the fleet, so I was here before working for Westpac, doing the resiliency briefs on the ships. And it's sure the construct and what it means to people and its overuse can have the ill-intended effect. There have been additional, like, mental toughness, warrior toughness. But the main thing about it, too, is everybody has their individual level. Everybody has their ability to snap back or break. So we cannot just one-size-fit-all it. We could look at just getting rid of the word altogether and just focus on the growing of their, you know, the things that we know will help. And some of those things are, how do you see your current situation as a way that challenges you and something that makes you stronger? Or do you have a sense of commitment and purpose, even though it's, you know, again, like, overwhelming? What is your commitment towards it? Do you have a sense of control over some circumstance of your life? Sure, you're on the ship, you're standing watch 12 hours a day. Where do you have a sense of control, and where can you really grow that? And do you share this with anyone else? Is there, like, that connection with anyone else that's probably in the same shoes as you are, that you can kind of find that way to, you know, be more, like, if not resilient, just maybe develop your grit, that it's an ongoing way to practice at developing yourself? And I tend to tell my patients this because I'm a little bit more older than everybody else.
No, you're more experienced. Let's get it straight.
I'm more seasoned. I do tell them, you know, your brain is maturing until it's about 25. Like, 25, your frontal cortex is already formed. So give yourself a break, you know, give yourself some time. It's not going to be like this forever. Hopefully your grit will, you know, transform or grow. A lot of times, additionally, you know, we talk about positive psychology and how we help develop that sense of purpose and hope. And when we talk more about that and we lean towards appreciation, that whole focus, that whole mind shift, that's where your resiliency comes out of it. And that's what we spend a lot of time trying to talk to or work through with our patients. So I hope that makes sense with what builds grit or what we can use to grow ourselves in those ways or snap back from the stress.
May I interject? I just want to say that I think part of building resiliency is to understand what resiliency means on just a dictionary level, and then to figure out what does it mean for that person or mm-hmm. that group of people you're speaking to. Because as you said, it is not a one-size-fits-all.
Mm-hmm.
And then especially the way that the military tries to take that and use that terminology, it's not always in the best way. It's kind of like you have to be, you need to be, instead of what can we do to help you build and to help support you so that you are resilient. It's more of a, you should already come to the game prepared, but instead of like, hey, do you need shoulder pads? Do you need gear? How can we gear you up to be ready for the fight?
I do agree with all the points here, as resiliency is something that you build upon what was already structured. But if you are looking for actual just resources, as you said, the military isn't really fond of giving you resources. They expect you to be resilient, be ready for the fight 100% of the time. But MWR does put out resiliency retreats 2 to 3 times a year. It might not be your cup of tea or anything, but you can always go in there, see what they have, sign up, and if you get a seat, you can go do some fun things and learn a lot about yourself and how to bring back that to others.
Excellent. The more that we can engage in those things early on, the better is the benefit for us. When you mentioned military and its response and its expectations, so I've been in the Navy for 17 years and have seen some tremendous growth and change. And some of those include get real, get better. And those tenets are really powerful because it talks about a learning mindset. It talks about psychological safety. Maybe people don't know what that means, but it's out there to be intended to mean that when we're having a conversation, you are going to fail safely, or you're going to be protected by me as your leader in a way that you don't feel threatened or demeaned. So they're putting all this out, and what comes out of that hopefully is better than what we have seen before. There's also, the Marines are doing a fantastic job of human factors councils. That's coming into the Navy side. Human factors councils identify people early enough where prevention can happen, and how they're focused on so that they can be supported, turned to resources, and monitored. So the military is doing its best to address things from every standpoint, and that's me as a mental health provider just kind of noticing that and being very relieved and appreciative that those efforts are coming out.
And as you brought up, for the Marine Corps putting out the human factors, they're equivalent to our MWR, is their MCCS, which does amazing work with the Marines and helping them get the point of care that they need for themselves and their families. So don't think we're forgetting about our Marine counterparts.
It's being able to stay engaged in this evolving, stressors on our military community, and the evolving trends that we see or the gains that we learn through mental health studies. That's one of those things that continues to make all of the military efforts around resiliency, suicide awareness, mental health awareness powerful, because it's not stagnant. As much as, people can point out things that don't work, the thing is that this is continuing to evolve and put every effort into supporting the community and the family members, who are all a part of it. And that, that's meaningful.
So when we're talking about social support, healthy habits, and then control, regardless of the amount of space, whether you're on deployment, just the amount of control you may have to help you feel sane, what roles do those things play in when it comes to resiliency and protective factors?
Strong, powerful, impactful roles to do any of those things, and putting it into a habitual pattern and a discipline will be so good in paying off that anything that's challenging and dark, that kind of starts to go away. So during COVID pandemic, I was here, and we were talking to the ships, and we were doing the sessions on the phone. And that was a really rough time because they had to be quarantined for weeks at a time on the dock or on the port, right? And couldn't come off the ship. And those are some really, really tough times for people. If you talk about people who were in service to the Marines were out in a hotel and doing who knows with whatever resources they had. It was tough for everyone. Let's just say that. And some amazing things come out of that because you really learn to discover yourself. And if you do a disciplined daily routine of that's predictable and that's helpful, it's something as basic as your eating and your sleeping and your activities and your exercise. And maybe if you do anything else to grow yourself, like reading books, or if you're a spiritual person, doing those things, doing that on a routine basis, that is some of the best behavior medicine, and it pays off well. So it was tough for a lot of us. Some of us, whatever we did, whatever came out of that, we're still dealing with some of those things. But those things that put into practice and habit, they do pay off pretty well. I wish we had patients or people who are understanding, who can speak to that, people who've come to mental health and speak for how it benefits them and how they would love to see that their peers or their colleagues come to mental health and reap the benefits of doing some of those strategies and how they're really helping them. A lot of times patients will say things like, you're just saying the things that I have in my head, and I just feel so good that you're just you understand what I'm thinking, and those kind of things. And so So the, anyway, in answer to your question, there's just a strong impact if you put that into practice.
To add on to that, those behavioral components too is also tackling the cognitive distortions that can happen. I really try and work with patients on understanding that as active duty military, there are certain things that are out of their control. But when we get into the headspace of nothing is in my control, right, then we give up a lot of our power, right? So some of those behavioral changes or consistent, you know, things that we do in our day-to-day can help remind ourselves that we have control of some things. I get to control what I eat. I might not control when I get off work, but I can control what I'm going to have for breakfast. I can control who I talk to when I am off work. And there's ways of empowering ourselves, even when those moments where we're like, no, I literally don't get to decide what I do today. Okay, I'm not going to argue with that. That is absolutely a fact. That does not mean all of your power and all of your control is, you know, out of your hands. So let's look at and recognize, yes, this is something I don't get to control today, but what do I get to control? And a lot of times people forget those things. They forget that they get to choose, do I talk to someone today? Do I reach out to someone? Do I write a letter? Do I let myself, you know, have a sweet treat today because I worked hard? Whatever that might be, those are things that they get to choose. And that in and of itself can really empower them and give them something to also ground themselves in.
Yes, I agree. Sometimes when I'm talking with my patients and they feel overwhelmed and that everything is out of their control, I have them give me a small list of everything that they've done that morning. When did you wake up? Did you take a shower? Did you brush your teeth? Did you do all this? These are things that were in your control. Now you can branch off that. What are the obstacles between if you're taking the bus in the morning? From your house to the bus stop, two block radius, what are the obstacles there? There aren't really any obstacles unless you figure in human factors. But for most part, you can control your day-to-day just by the little things. So as long as you bring that back, you have some control and you can actually push that out into the world to gain more control over your military life, even though we don't really have that much control. We have more control than a lot of people think. But as long as you remember the little things that you do have control over, it can make a big difference in your day.
And to jump off that, especially with some of those examples, right, is sometimes people will get so really stuck in, no, I have to brush my teeth. I have to get to the bus. I have to. Okay, well, what if you skip brushing your teeth today? What, you know, do it as an act of rebellion because who? Your chief isn't going to send you home if you have some dirty teeth and some stinky mouth. They might say something to you, but they're not going to send you home. So if you want to just prove to yourself, do that.
Yeah,
you know?
The caveat is what is the bad that can come of it?
Right.
If you skip brushing your teeth, the bad may be, gingivitis or something down the line if you keep doing it. It's a repeated action. But there's nothing really bad that can come out of, like, skipping one or two things occasionally.
Right.
But again, that's within your control.
Yes. Have breakfast for dinner. Have a steak for breakfast. Whatever. Something that allows you to go, wait a minute. I don't have to do these specific things a specific way, especially if I'm just not in the mood. Right? That's a way that we can also regain some of that sense of autonomy and uniqueness and, you know, even if it's just a little act of rebellion, not brushing your teeth that day. Whatever.
And to go off what you were stating about deployments earlier and your resiliency factors or protective factors that come in, that things that you love to do, if you love reading books, playing video games, yeah, you can't take a video game system out in the field, obviously, but you can, like, bring books or stuff, things that keep you grounded, because sometimes you can be on back-to-back deployments. I've been on too many to count. So you need stuff that can bring you back to yourself without being lost in the deployment. And that means you're being out there days on end, little sleep, being woken up to do pretty much anything, weapons check at midnight. I've done that.
Cleaning stations.
It's a rough time. So you need things that can keep you grounded while you're in the midst of things.
I know I get a lot of cringe from a certain set of our military population, but journaling is so powerful.
Oh, yeah.
It is so powerful. And, you know, people, I'm not good at it. No, I don't. This is, you're not trying to write, you know, the bestseller. You're just writing for yourself. And just the act, I try and express, like, it's not about what you write, but the fact that you're writing, like, we have studies that show just the act of writing and getting it out activates our brain. It really helps us purge stuff that we might not even realize is racing around in there. And it can be a really big stress reliever if you just allow yourself to try and not judge it, not judge the process.
Yes, and that goes a lot with people that are more like antisocial or don't like talking to people and like expressing their feelings. This goes to a lot of the higher enlisted, the people that's been in over 15 years because, well, mental health wasn't a stigma for a long of that, so they don't get the opportunity to talk out about it. But journaling comes into place because if you can put it on paper, it's not in your head anymore.
Yes.
And that sometimes can be a very powerful relief system to a lot of people.
Yes. And sometimes people will get a little anxious, like, I don't want people reading what I wrote. I'm roommating or whatever. Then tear it up, you know.
Burn it.
Yeah. Put it in the toilet. It doesn't matter. It's not about keeping it and saving it as a memoir. It's getting it out.
I think it's for people who struggle with sleep, it's really a good way to write a list and put it away so that you can get to sleep. Some of my patients have told me when they journal, sometimes they just go deeper in the hole. So I try and give them some structure as to, like, well, let's just kind of focus on three things that you have appreciation for. That way they can do more of that positive psychology and have a good fuzzy and go to sleep so that those are the last thoughts on their mind. So, you know, some patients, people know how best they perform or what makes, they know themselves best. And, you know, so we kind of go on that to what are your strengths? What are you really good at? And let's capitalize on that in some way. So there's so many interventions and they all work with consistency.
Speaking of interventions, I don't know if this is an okay time, but I didn't see it on your list. One of the things that I wanted to be able to talk about, though, is postventions. Was that on your list?
This is just a list of just to bring out, but no, I'm open to, I mean, really anything with regards to mental health, but specifically today, suicide prevention and awareness, anything that can help broaden people's minds on the topic and help them get resources or information about it so they don't feel, a lot of what we were talking about are things that people feel like they're not doing it right. What is the right way? Like, what's the right way to talk about suicide? You just do it.
You just do it.
Right?
Don't hide from the words. Don't hide from the questions. Just talk about it.
And sometimes if you don't know how to tell somebody something, just blurt it out.
Yes.
And then figure it out if you have to.
Well, when we're talking about postventions, we're actually talking about the impact and what to do after a suicide has happened. Because I think that's something that oftentimes gets overlooked. I've actually been out to the ships after a suicide so that we can talk to the service members and support the team. Because the people, actually one of the research studies that the VA put out shows that for every suicide that occurs, 135 people are impacted. And so they've rounded that up to 5.5 million people in the U.S. every year are impacted by suicide. And unfortunately, the military and veteran community is 56 to 65% impacted by suicide. And so one of those things that's really important is to understand is that we want to do everything we can to prevent it. But we're still in a place where it does happen, and that's not where the conversation doesn't stop at death. It still needs to continue. Support is still needed. Unfortunately, we do see impacts as men are more likely to have suicidal ideations after a loved one or friend or even coworker suicides. And so women are at a higher risk of being diagnosed with mental health disorders. And this is all data that's been conducted by our Veterans Affairs. So being able to understand that there is still a stigma for the loved ones of someone who has committed suicide, and then it makes it hard for them to reach out and talk about it. So there's that, the stigma component, where there's still a struggle of feeling like, I failed my person. I failed my coworker. I failed my spouse. I failed my friend. And being able to say it out loud, those feelings, and be able to gain support. It could be with family and friends. It can be with a mental health counselor. It can be with a chaplain. There's grief support groups specifically for people who've lost loved ones and are grieving someone who committed suicide. It's one of those things that I think needs to be a part of these conversations, because the ripple effect does not just stop once that person who has had those ideations commit suicide.
Well, yeah, because it's not a small pond. It's more like a tidal wave, you know. It's a major impact on all those that are involved, because it takes one person to commit suicide for everyone else to think, what could I have done?
Yes.
What didn't I do?
Yes.
What could I have done better? And, I mean, it's good to improve on those things, but that life is gone. You can't bring that back.
And that's where we also go back to power and control,
mm-hmm.
right? I mean, even as mental health providers here, we are trained, we are experienced, we do safety plans, we do resiliency checks, we do all sorts of coping strategies with people all the time. And we have to sit as professionals with knowing I am ultimately not in control of if this person does something. And if it impacts us, not in our professional setting, in our personal lives, that is a whole other ripple effect, right? Because we're like, wait a minute, this is my area of expertise. Why didn't they turn to me? And so it doesn't matter how professional we are or how educated we are or how much experience we have.
Mm-hmm.
We do not control those we love and care about ultimate decisions. And sitting with that afterwards is really hard. It's not an easy thing. And that's where we kind of come back to connection, is isolating ourselves, getting stuck in those negative thoughts, having our helpful behaviors and routines disrupted, and not able to get back into it. Those all become risk factors for us personally. And so just being aware that the conversation continues, that there is support. Mental health providers are here for people who are grieving loss. And that's, I think that's something that's just really important to be able to talk about.
Sure.
And no, I was going to agree, and I think it's especially hard for it being in the military, because with us, the mission never ends. So just because somebody did commit the act of suicide doesn't mean that the workday stops. And that can impact everybody around that person, meaning his coworkers, his leadership, his command, his CO. Everyone down the line
yes.
is affected, but yet they still have to go on. And that's why we're here as mental health professionals. We put together our sprint teams. We go out, we talk. And we hope that we do an impact, but at the end of the day, as you said, we're not in control of anyone else's actions but our own. So we can do everything we can and honestly just hope for the best.
Mm-hmm.
But in the military, like I said, it can be difficult.
It but can be.
We do have things in play to help you.
Yes, leaders, if a death by suicide occurs, leaders will initiate a sprint. Sprint stands for suicide prevention rapid intervention team. So we all have experience with doing those missions, and that's the whole point of it, is to create a pause, and also to do psychological first aid. And any grief, any death, a suicide carries with it a lot more guilt. So that survivor guilt and that grief can be impacted. But just to note, on grief alone, grief is not pathological whatsoever. Grief, you can talk to anybody, and do encourage all people to kind of talk about, you know, the loss they feel when they are suffering from somebody who's passed. There are so many resources out there. So keeping in mind, you know, the people who compartmentalize because the mission has to go forward, it's still going to stay there. So it's encouraged to kind of deal with it. That's why we allow those sprints. But if, you know, you rather deal with it after the mission, you know, and you're encouraged to seek that support.
And, you know, I think it's also important to recognize, like, first responders because, you know, our MAs, our medical teams, sometimes bystanders, they all end up becoming first responders. And then they're grieving and they're in shock and they have a trauma and stress response. And sometimes that can be confusing because, you know, if like, why am I grieving this person I didn't even know? Well, they're still in, you know, we are a herd animal. We are still very much a tribe, and the military is a community that is very much connected. So just because you don't know this person, there's still this sense of, but they're my people, and so to come across someone, even if we don't know them, the loss of them, seeing how or just knowing that they are no longer with us, that they are people grieving them, can still impact people. And that is not something that they need to feel ashamed or confused of, do I have a right? You are experiencing it, so come and talk to us about it. I've seen that happen, especially with first responders. Well, I shouldn't say first responders, but just responders who aren't actually trained, who just unfortunately came across a situation and just went into action mode, where they felt a lot of confusion and conflict about their, you know, post response. And so just being able to sit and give them a safe space to deconstruct what happened and how that has shifted things for them is very meaningful and can reduce the chances of them having PTSD, having, you know, a diagnosis later of depression or anxiety. And so we want to just make sure that people understand that there are resources, that their experience, even if it's vicarious, is valid. I think the only other thing that I think is important to also understand around grief in general is that there isn't a timeline. There is really not this fine, like, you know what, it's been a week, it's time to get over it.
Yeah.
It's been 3 months. Come on now. Let's not. Why are you still crying over? There is going to be waves of grief and waves of different emotions, and knowing, kind of going back to almost the safety plan of just knowing, who can I talk to? I don't care if it's been 3 years. I might, you know, have this new experience, and all of a sudden I wish this person was there. I wish I could call them up. And so now, even though I'm happy, I'm having this huge wave of grief and I want to cry. Who's going to be able to be someone I can turn to and talk to? And so understanding that that is normal, that that is acceptable, and to just keep that in mind, keep those resources, regardless if they're professional resources or if they're personal resources. You know, those are important things to give yourself permission.
Does anybody have any final thoughts that they want to input?
I do. So I want to just address the resources that we have.
Please do.
So if you're having thoughts or anything, go to somebody that you know that you can count on, maybe friends, family, then reach out to leadership or your corpsman. If you're on a ship, go to medical. If you're with the Marines, call doc. And we will always support you to get you where you need to go. On the Yokosuka base, we have our mental health department over in E22. It's a little subsect of the hospital. You can always find us over there. I'm there, available all the time. And we will see you, evaluate, and help you get the help that you need. And we work on different levels. So it could be you just need to talk that day, or you need ongoing therapy, and we can set you up. And if we can't help you there, we have the resources to refer you out to where you need to go.
I have a quote I would like to share, and if you find a spot, you'd like to add it.
Okay.
So there's this quote by David Kessler. Each person's grief is as unique as their fingerprint. But what everyone has in common is that no matter how they grieve, they share a need for their grief to be witnessed. That doesn't mean needing someone to try to lessen it or reframe it for them. The need is for someone to be fully present in the magnitude of their loss without trying to point out the silver lining.
I don't have any lasting thoughts. I just have a phrase. It's just like, it starts and ends with connection.
Bringing it all together.
Yeah. And, you know, we as therapists don't even have to say a word. We could just be there present, like you're saying, and just listen and be there with non-judgment. So what a great opportunity just to talk amongst mental health peers and professionals and yourself, and just really makes me feel really proud of what I do. So thank you for this.
I thank you for all bringing all the bit of experience and wisdom that you all have that can now be shared to whoever and whomever decide to listen to this podcast, and in the hopes that this information helps not only them, but all the people connected to them. So I thank you for coming today. It's been a pleasure. It's been an honor. And as a survivor, as a person who now takes antidepressants because he was strong enough to reach out, thank you for everything that all of you do. It is not a small task. It is a very heavy pull. And I thank you for pulling that weight. That's going to wrap up today's episode of the Giant Voice Podcast. Huge thanks to Lieutenant Commander Vedva, HM2 Finch, and Miss Philpott for sitting down with me and sharing their insight. And just a reminder, if you or someone you know is struggling, you are not alone. Of course, if you're in the U.S., you can dial 988 and press 1 for the Military Crisis Line, or reach out to Chaplain Services, Fleet and Family, or the Behavioral Health Clinic here at Yokosuka. Every voice matters and every life matters. Thank you for listening. And we'll catch you on the next episode.
The Giant Voice Podcast is a production of Commander Fleet Activities Yokosuka Public Affairs Office. The views expressed in this podcast do not necessarily reflect the policy of the Department of the Navy or Department of Defense. Thanks for listening.